Hello and welcome to Beyond the Back Page on Near FM with myself, Patrick Donoghue. On the show today, I'm delighted to be joined by Brendan Dial, who is aiming to qualify for the next Winter Olympics. And I'm delighted to say that Brendan has popped into the studio to join us. Brendan, how are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me in.
So, Brendan, I mentioned that's the aim, to qualify for the next Winter Olympics. Skeleton is your sport. Can you tell us a little bit, how did you get into skeleton?
For one, skeleton is it's one of three ice sliding sports. So you have luge and probably more commonly known bobsleigh. So if you've seen Cool Runnings, that's the story of the Jamaican bobsled team in Calgary in 1988. So for those who don't know that sport, first of all, go see Cool Runnings. It's an awesome movie.
It's an iconic.
And I'll explain what it is. So we compete on an ice track made up of kind of banked corners. So it's similar to when you go down a water slide, the way you get picked up as you twist. That's the same thing in skeleton. But we go down on sleds that kind of look like tea trays. They're flat sleds with kind of steel rods underneath. And we'll actually drive down. So we'll use our shoulders and our knees to twist the sled during the corners. In the corners, we'll experience up to six times our body weight pushing down on us. And we'll hit speeds of up to 145 kilometers an hour. So it's an adrenaline rush, to say the least. And this is what I want to try to do. And this is my goal, is to represent Ireland in Beijing in 2022.
Yeah, and like Ireland, as I said before, it's not associated with winter sports. And how did you get in at the start? How did you get interested in the sport?
Well, that was basically, so I'm a local lad. I started playing football with Artane Beaumont as a young lad. And it was when I went to St. David's in Artane, I got into track and field. Because my history teacher got me involved in that. And I would train up in Morton Stadium. It's the National Athletics Stadium. And at that time, there was a bob team training. So kind of like Cool Runnings, where they have a sled on a set of wheels. They were pushing on the athletics track. And they came over to me and asked me, did I want to give it a go? And Laura Clifton Rollisley finished fourth for Ireland in 2002 in Salt Lake at the Olympic Games there. That would have been pretty much my kind of grasp of the sport, but it still looked amazing and I wanted to give it a go. I had a lot of transferable skills from athletics, which lended well to skeleton. So I gave it a go. I trained in the track for a couple of months. And then they took me off to get my driving license. So you need to do your driving, like a driving school.
Right, okay.
And I did mine out in Eagles, which is just Innsbruck in Austria.
Yeah.
And there's a week of sliding there where they teach you the ropes and they get you from top to the bottom of the track and they kind of certify you competent. And it was, I only got basically maybe a week or two of sliding and then I had to stop because the funding wasn't there to support. We had a couple of guys on board and I was young at the time, so we had more developed athletes in terms of physically. So they basically said, if you can't fund it yourself, you're going to have to stop. So I had to stop, and I kind of went on to pursue my professional goals at that stage. But that was, that was back in 2003. So, you know, here I am now.
Yeah, and you mentioned profession. You had to, you went off to become a guard. How did you like being a guard?
I've always wanted to be a guard. You know, from a young age, I always volunteered. I worked with Order of Malta. I was, you know, in Scouting Ireland. I did some time with the Auxiliary Fire Service. I just wanted to give. And the guards kind of offered a really unique opportunity. And there was a lot of job satisfaction in it. So I loved it. It was a great, rewarding job. Tough, very, very tough, very stressful, but so rewarding. I loved my time in the Gardaí.
Yeah, and while you're a guard, Brendan, an incident occurred that had a real profound impact on your life. Do you mind just maybe telling us a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, so basically when I was stationed in an inner city Dublin, station and we were called out to a domestic. Now, Gardaí face domestic calls all the time. Yeah. And they're kind of one of the most volatile calls we would have to deal with because it's so emotional. Yeah. It's so emotionally driven. And we're an outsider coming in trying to kind of find a middle ground, which is very difficult. And this particular call was no exception to that. You know, there was a report of the suspect kind of beating up the injured party. So when we got into work, this was already on the radio. So I barely got time to get my stab vest and such on.
Yeah.
So we raced out to the address, and when I arrived, I was met by kind of the suspect, and they were holding a weapon in their hand.
Right. Okay.
Now, as a guard, I always relied on my verbal reasoning skills. You know, you always try to talk someone down and you try to find the rational side. Nine times out of 10, that's effective. But of course, this time it wasn't.
Right.
And, you know, the suspect raised the weapon over their head.
Yeah.
And I fell for my safety and my fellow officer's safety. You know, we're stood there and this person has a weapon in their hand and, you know, we have an injured party behind them screaming and you know, injured, covered in blood. So, you know, it wasn't a far stretch to believe that we were in danger. And it was when I took measures to protect myself by taking out my baton. He ran into the back of the house and that's where they were armed with a chef's knife. And it was during the arrest where I sustained injuries to my hand. And I am, you know, I've lacerations to my right thumb where the nerves have been cut and the my right small finger, the ligaments are like my fingers always at this 90 degree. And that's something that I'm going to face for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So I'll get operations to open it up and it's just going to come back to the way it is now. So that's a kind of lifetime of skin grafts and ligaments from different parts of my body to try to repair it. But being an athlete, I kind of, I'm used to physical injury and I was able to deal with that.
Yeah.
No problem. You know, it was more the mental side, which I was completely unprepared for. And it kind of takes you gradually. So I remember getting home that night and I got back to my folks and told them I was all right and had a cup of tea with them and, you know, everything was fine.
Yeah.
And, I went to bed and slept like a baby. But that was my last night's sleep for about 6 years.
Okay, wow.
So insomnia kind of really took a hold of me. It started off with night terrors. I would dream that the suspect was standing over me with the knife.
Okay.
Or I'd wake up grabbing my hand, thinking it was still bleeding, or my bed was covered in blood.
Yeah.
And these were extremely kind of visceral, like real dreams. It's not just like a nightmare.
Yeah.
You open your eyes and it takes you a minute to realize that you're in your bed. And that happened night after night. And it's very exhausting to be woken up like that. So I started having problems going to sleep knowing that this was going to happen. So the insomnia crept in, and that for me was the biggest catalyst to everything else falling apart. Like we've all had that kind of night's sleep. And you're just in a bad mood all day. You know, and you're in your bed and you're so aware that you have to be up at a certain time, and 5 minutes feels like 2 hours. It's awful. So, you know, at the worst of things, I would get in my car and drive to Cork and back. Just to fill the night. Because I mean, you're doing this. I mean, I have to remind you that this was the daily for, you know, 6 years. So you start to feel like you're a prisoner in your own bedroom, you have to fill the time. So that was the first stage. And then I kind of crept in and, you know, I would try to return to work. Again, I'm falling back on my athlete kind of life. Get back on the horse. And the best way to kind of heal an injury is just gradually, you know, build it up. And I was sitting in a patrol car one day and we got this very, very kind of like nothing call. Go to an area and check it out. And I just remember feeling my stab vest feeling like a ton and my tie kind of closing in around my throat. And I'm an asthmatic, so I thought it was an asthma attack. But it was actually my first panic attack. And I literally, it took me by surprise. It was literally the most physical thing I've ever felt in my life. So that was obviously something I went back to my sergeant and I said, this has happened. I don't know what's going on. And he told me, you need more time off. You need to go back and you need to figure this out. So I went back and on sick leave to try to get better and to get back on my feet. And things just kind of start spiraling out of control. Again, I still wasn't sleeping.
Yeah.
I was frustrated that I wasn't in work. I felt like a burden to everyone around me. Mm. You know, I was letting my unit down because, you know, there was one less officer on the street, all this kind of stuff. It all just kind of built up on me. And it was, for me, it was a case of not being able to have that night's sleep to reset.
Yeah.
So depression started to be a real factor, and feeling like I wasn't able to get back on my feet was frustrating. So I stopped doing the things that I loved. I stopped eating right. I stopped training. You know, my relationship at the time with my girlfriend fell apart. Everything, all my social connections all fell apart. And it's funny because I'm looking back at it now, and saying that, it sounds like a big deal, but it didn't feel like a big deal. It was just this really weird things where it's like, oh, you know, I would play it off. I would feel like the tiffs were just tiffs and they weren't significant. But, you know, looking back, it obviously was. So you've got a lot of depression, insomnia, panic attacks. And this is just a weight on my back all day, every day. And again, 6 years.
It's a long time.
It really is. And it's like... you can't, it's hard to kind of get how much that takes out of you. It's hard to kind of quantify that. It really is. So what happened was I found myself trying to get back to work and going back to spots and it was just, nothing was working. And one day I felt that my only option to gain control and to stop this kind of flurry of like, kind of turbulent energy in my mind and, you know, to get rid of this feeling of like being tired but not being able to sleep, you know, I made the decision to try to take my life. And if it wasn't for a chance meeting with someone who just spotted me, and that person's never going to know what happened, but there was a small girl and her mum there, and I couldn't do it in front of them, so I stopped. And I went back to my car and I broke down. I broke down and I cried. And I went back to my friend and we went to Tesco's and I just said to him, this is what's after happening. I'm telling you because I'm not okay and I want to be held accountable. And if I kept this to myself, I would convince myself to try again. But now I'm telling you, I'm not expecting you to do anything. I just want to let you know that I'm not okay and this happened. And he just turned around and said, get back to the gym.
Right.
You know? So he knew what it was, for me, what it meant for me to be able to train. And, you know, it was a long road, you know, again, going from training for six days a week in my athletics. I eventually kind of just tried to do one day a week. And, it didn't always go well, but, I remember that was the kind of first sign of like this kind of positive reward within me, this kind of like, I'm looking forward to something and I feel like I've achieved something. And I felt when I was training hard, I would get sleep, I'd be too tired not to sleep. So, these are all kind of small little positive steps that I took to get back on my feet. And, you know, I would not be here if it wasn't for that chance encounter for that like young girl and her mum, and if it wasn't for sport. I am an extremely lucky man, so I owe a lot to luck.
And it's incredible, and thanks very much for sharing your story, Brendan. Does that given that such low point you have now that you're now that you're on practicing and training for your sport, does that really, the fact that you really, really were, things were so low, does that really, really get you to kind of appreciate and actually make you so focused on what you're doing right now?
Absolutely. It's lit a kind of a fire inside me. I appreciate life on a whole new level. I appreciate my body on a whole new level. You know, I train hard and it's not a normal thing to be able to do. And I'm very lucky to be able to do this. You know, I'm looking back and I couldn't commit to, you know, going downstairs to clean up the kitchen. I couldn't commit to doing that. And I'm now committing the next 3 years of my life to this adrenaline-filled, like mentally driven sport. It's full of fear.
Yeah.
And I'm taking it literally head on. And it just goes to show that, like, I felt in my darkest point that I was, like, worthless and I couldn't amount to anything and I was just a failure. And now I'm pushing to represent Ireland at the highest stage at the Olympic Games, and in a sport that, I mean, I don't really have that much of a kind of a structured support system. Yeah. I'm like one of the first guys to be doing this. So, you know, I don't have the big organization, you know, doing all the bits and bobs. So I basically have to do everything. Mm. And I take great pride in how far I've come.
Yeah.
And on the flip side, I have a personal goal of spreading this message. Mm. I'm so, so passionate about, you know, not only, you know, talking about getting this, not taboo, but getting this idea that you're weak if you're suffering from like ADA, if you're weak from suffering from PTSD or anything like that, any of these mental health conditions, it takes immense strength to live with this and get up every day.
Yeah.
And like, people don't appreciate that. Mm. It's extremely, extremely hard to live with this.
Yeah.
You know, it's the equivalent of asking someone with a broken leg to run.
Yeah.
It's just that difficult. Mm. And, you know, I just want to scream it from the rooftops that not only can you beat these mental health issues, you can actually grow because of them. Yeah. And I look back now and it sounds kind of weird that I say this, but I'm kind of thankful for what happened to me because I'm more capable now than I ever have been. And I really, really want to get the message out because I'm lucky. I got lucky.
Yeah.
And I don't want other people to rely on luck because lady luck doesn't hang around too long.
And a lot of people, I've heard people that have been in similar situations, and what a lot of people say is just making that first chat, having a chat with a friend. And is that something you found? Like once, I'd imagine it's a weight off your shoulders when you have a chat with someone and it's not being internalized as much.
It makes it real. Mm. It makes what happened real because the easiest person to fool is yourself.
Yeah.
And when you have someone who cares for you, that knows what's going on, I mean, they're going to kind of hold you accountable. Yeah. And that's that little bit of accountability is quite productive. Yeah. It didn't feel like a massive weight off my shoulders when I said it.
Yeah.
Right. So I didn't say it and I was like, oh, I feel better now.
Yeah, yeah.
It was more of a, okay, he knows.
Yeah.
All right. So teacher's watching kind of thing. And it just basically guided me in the direction I needed. Again, I was still weak at that stage, so it wasn't like just having a conversation is going to make everything great.
Yeah.
But it's that, as you said, it's that first step.
Yeah.
And you know, that's for me, that was one of the biggest things that I've done, is just saying it to my friend, and you know, it's been amazing now.
Mm. And the aim now is to qualify for the next Olympics, next Winter Olympics. Yeah. How's the preparations going for that?
So the Olympic quad is like the 4 years of the Olympic Games. I set out a kind of a roadmap. It's something kind of like I always do, whether it be for training or whatnot. I set out an end goal and then work my way back to now, you know, just putting small milestones in. And I missed out at the last Olympic Games by 1 point, absolute, like February 2018 was a really tough month for me. Yeah. It was right down to the very, very end. Like it was maybe 2 weeks before the Olympics that I found out.
Yeah.
And I asked a lot of questions of myself in February, and I kind of doubted my ability. Mm. And, you know, I just said that this isn't how my story ends. I don't accept this. This is not how I want it to end. And as long as you have that kind of fire inside, you can alter your destiny. Mm. And that's kind of what I'm doing right now. So, and I'm so glad I held out because last season I had a breakthrough year. Mm. You know, I got my career first medal out in Park City in Utah. Mm. I broke personal best at every single track I went to, be it my downtime or my top speeds. Mm. Everything was going in the right direction.
Mm.
And that kind of all accumulated in at the World Championships in Whistler this year. Mm. So we were out competing. My goal was just to have good, consistent runs. Mm. I had no real expectations. Yeah. But I finished 22nd, which was Ireland's highest finish at a World Championships to date.
Yeah, yeah.
And I took immense pride with that.
Yeah.
You know, and I was a competitive sled. I never felt like, it's not enough for me just to be flying the flag out there for my country. I want to be a competitive sled. I'm taking a professional approach to this. And, you know, to get those results is massive, because I know within me I can do this. And just to have that year where you're getting the good results, that set me up perfectly. I'm a year ahead of where I thought I would be. I've qualified Ireland for the World Cup, which is the highest level of competition. We've not had a World Cup spot since 2013. So to finally get back up into that spot was massive for me. And I wasn't planning that until the year before the Olympic Games. So I'm in a fantastic spot right now. I'm working super hard. And this year I'm heading off to Europe mainly. Now, I normally compete in North America, but this year I'm going to go Europe, and I need to just learn all the tracks in Europe. So this year for me is not necessarily about, you know, times and competitions. It's about increasing my knowledge as an athlete. So when it gets to the Olympics, I have everything squared off and I know what I'm doing.
And funding is always an issue, and in Ireland, and it's such a minority sport. How do you fund yourself? Do you get any grants from any the Olympic organizations, or how do you keep going, like, to fund this dream?
So, I mean, funding is the biggest bottleneck. So up to this year, or up to last year, really, I was self-funded. I worked off my savings in the Gardaí, and I've poured everything into this. And, you know, it's a lot of money. But I feel that if you can't invest in yourself, no one else will. And it's what I had to do. So right now I was a recipient of a discretionary fund from the Olympic Federation of Ireland. Which was incredible. It's gone a long way, and I'm applying for every grant under the sun, but I am completely dependent on outside sponsorship, outside donations. The first half of last year, which would have been October, November, December, was solely done off donations from people, and it was during that period where I received my first career medal. It is the lifeline. I 100% depend on this. I have put my heart and soul into this up to this point, and financially I just don't have anything left. So, you know, our sport is an incredible spectacle. It's an amazing sport to watch. It's pure racing. You know, there's like 500 million people tune in a year to watch this sport. You know, it's all over the world. It's, you know, it just jumps out at you when you watch it, and you've got so many questions, and it's, I am working as hard as I can as an athlete, but I'm also media, marketing. I'm trying to get the federation up to a certain standard. So I'm kind of like a Swiss Army knife right now, and there's a lot there. There really is. So to have a sponsor stand in and help, you know, I look for a kind of a meaningful partnership, someone who I can help and they can help me. It's massive. But right now I'm holding my breath and just crossing my fingers, my toes, to hope that someone steps in and helps out.
And if anyone's listening in that may be interested, how can they reach you?
Yeah, absolutely. So all my social media is at Face Doyle, FaceDoyle. And my website is slidingirish.com. You can reach out there anytime. You know, I love to hear from people as well. It's great to kind of see people kind of jumping on and seeing what the sport is all about. But they're my links there.
Well, Brendan, listen, I really appreciate you popping into the studio. It's been an incredibly incredible story, and very inspiring. So thanks again for popping into the studio and joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Brendan Doyle joining us in the studio. That's pretty much it for this evening. I'd sincerely like to thank my guest in studio, Brendan Doyle, for joining us today to share his story. A really, really incredible, inspiring person. I'm recording this show on a Monday, and it really, really has given me motivation on a Monday. So thanks a mil for Brendan for tuning in. That's it for this week. For more sport on Near FM, you can tune in to Fergus Carroll at 10:30 on Saturday, and you can tune in. I'll be back at the same time next Thursday. So thanks a million for tuning in, and I'll talk to you at the same time next week. Enjoy your sporting week.